Okay. This is a standard question. Isn't desire needed for lay life? Starting a family, business, etc. What about polio? Would there be things like a vaccine for polio without desire? Did the Buddha have something else in mind? Help. He did have something else in mind. There's two different words for desire. In terms of the Four Noble Truths, suffering, cause of suffering, cessation of suffering, say the cause of suffering being desire, the word is tanha. And tanha is desire that is always bound up with greed, hatred, and delusion, and always ends in suffering. That's a it's very straightforward. And then there's another word for desire that is more neutral, so that it has and tends to be qualified. Generally, when it's on its own, it has a say a positive connotation. So that and the word is chanda. And when it's on, say as an example of that, in a positive light, then say there's in the sets of teachings called the say the Wings to Awakening, 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. There are different sets of teachings, and one of those sets is are the four bases of success: chanda, wirya, jitta, vimamsa. Chanda is the first one. Desire, effort, application of mind, and investigation. So chanda is an essential piece of the whole kind of enlightenment process, awakening process. Also, saying it needs to be qualified, so that we're talking about the hindrances this morning. That's kama chanda. So that, say, desire for sensuality. Kama is sensuality. Also have dhamma chanda, desire for dhamma, desire for the truth. Kusala chanda, desire for the wholesome, desire for the good. So that those are, that desire is a normal. I mean, it's a bit confusing in the English language because it's there isn't much nuance to the word, but in the scriptural language, and there's different words, and even within the word that has a very positive meaning, it still is also can be qualified in a different way. So one has to look at the context, but certainly desire as motivation, as interest, is essential, whether it's in the whether it's in the world or whether it's in the practice of Dhamma. Okay, I was wondering that you are a monk of over 40 years. You are being with happiness and mindful. How can you know the issues, problems, etc. of people's lives in their current modern lives? And then we're worried about Trump's presidency. part of being in a monastery is that the way that the Buddha set it up is that monasteries are, let's say, we need to rely on alms food each day, so that we have to have contact with the lay people, the lay world. The monasteries are open places that people can come and stay, and they do all the time. There's always a waiting list at Ubayagiri for people to come and stay. There's always people coming for day visits, and they will bring their concerns and worries and perspectives, and that's part of, being, as a young monk, oftentimes you don't have to deal with stuff like that. As you gain more experience, then people come to you for advice, and that one gets to hear about all sorts of things. Things I don't even want to know about. And on a certain level, I think a monastery is a because one's in the middle of the society. We get to hear many, many different perspectives of people's lives and their experience, as opposed to most people tend to live their life within a certain sphere of commonality and don't really get to have much experience with people with different views, other perspectives, other backgrounds. I think that's one of the things of a monastery is there's a real diverse a pool of participants in a monastery, and one gets to have it's quite privileged really to be able to have that kind of broad perspective and broad spectrum of other people's experience, and so that's something that is it's really helpful. And if you're worried about Trump's presidency, that's probably means your reason you've got. But I'd be these days. I mean, in terms of the you have to look at it from a perspective of cause and effect, and that's what the Dhamma does, is sort of lift it up and spread it out and look at it rather than from a narrow perspective of one's own preference and one's own particular viewpoint, recognizing that there's a whole range of causes and conditions within the culture that have sort of brought this about. And if one is an appropriate response is not just to kind of moan and complain about being a helpless victim of circumstance, but okay, what is one going to do? How is one going to engage to bring about something positive? So I'm worried too. But it's I think some things are worth worrying about. But it says one needs to deal with it skillfully. Okay, this is kind of begins with a quote. Though unskillful mind states may come up, as long as we don't pick them up and feed them, they're just ideas, thoughts, and they will end. Can you comment on the effectiveness of this practice? Are there situations where you would definitely recommend it? Definitely not recommend it. Do you see this relating to metta? I mean, I think one of the things is one of the standards that the Buddha gave to gauge whether or not, a practice is fruitful or beneficial is by investigating and seeing, do wholesome mind states increase and unwholesome mind states decrease, or do wholesome mental mind states decrease and the unwholesome mind states increase. So that sometimes it is a valid approach just to, you know, not pick them up, not feed them, and they'll end, because they will. But sometimes it doesn't work, and one has to be proactive, because sometimes just being, yeah, just not feeding the process of what's unskillful and having a watchfulness and alertness to, okay, I need to be careful around this. And then knowing that there's a, because some unskillful mind states, there's a certain, they're so charged that however we approach them, they just hook us in. So then that's where it's helpful to be willing to step back a bit and just be alert and present, but very, very cautious, because those unskillful states will increase. And by letting it cease, there's a strength gained, and a confidence. I said, okay, this doesn't define me. It is unskillful, it is unwholesome, but it doesn't define me, and it's not me, it's not mine, it's not personal. I can relinquish it. But, you know, there's also times when you have to be really proactive and engage in the process of either relinquishing, either seeing the danger, seeing the drawback, seeing the difficulty in this, or by lifting up something that is wholesome, that's positive, that's skillful, so that one is replacing, say, unskillful trains of thought, of moods of the mind. And of course, metta is one of the tools that one can use to lift up wholesome mental states, lifting up skillful states. There's lots of others. Okay. Dear Lumpo, I'm so grateful for your generous teachings. I'm training my mind, and I'm so glad for the Dhamma in my life. However, I'm experiencing migraine attacks almost daily, and therefore a lot of uncertainty and dukkha. Will I be able to function today? How bad will it be? Will I throw up? Which medicine will be the most beneficial today? Which side effects can I deal with today? Work with my mind under these conditions is challenging, but I'm up for the challenge at least some of the time. I could use some encouragement, please. And I think one of the things is a time when it's helpful to be proactive in lifting up wholesome mental states, so that rather than neutrally observing miserable feelings, it's really okay. I've got the energy. I've got the interest right now. I can lift up particular thoughts of compassion for oneself, and recognizing, yeah, this is difficult, this is uncomfortable, not trying to sugarcoat it or make it into something else, but sort of lifting up that quality of compassion and that wish that through this experience of dukkha, may I gain more skill, more wisdom in dealing with this so that I can help myself and help others. So that's a, you know, sort of a, it's a way to encourage oneself and lift up, using that, the emotion of compassion. Using dukkha is kind of the progenitor or the motivating force, but the result is can be a wholesome mental state, and that tends to be being able to hold something that is difficult or is unpleasant with a quality of say of patience. And patience isn't just sort of putting up with something, waiting for it to be over, but patience is the willingness to be present with what one's experiencing, and then how can I tweak it, how can I work with it, how can I take an interest in it in the sense of what's possible right now. And in doing that, it's important that one doesn't come from a place of idealism, because that's one of the things that really undermines us, is sort of setting some ideal of I'm a Buddhist practitioner, and I should just sit with it, or I should, you know, be glowing with loving kindness all the time. You know, it's just this is being kind to oneself, being compassionate to oneself, and then using that as a seed or as a, you know, a motivating force for one's seeing, well, what is going to work today, because you're never sure. And especially with migraines, and it's really not sure. And then, you know, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But being holding it with a quality of compassion. Okay. Can I be aware of my mind states while I am aware of my breath? It doesn't seem so. Back to the cushion. yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the that is the instruction in the mindfulness of breathing, is that starts to encompass all the different aspects of our experience, all of the the four foundations of mindfulness: feeling, mind states. And I think it's important to, and I think I touched on it in my talk, that not conceiving of it, because sometimes we conceive of, like, in order to meditate, I have to fully absorb and have just a, almost like a pure experience of just the breath. But that's really not what the Buddha taught. I think it's an idealized conceptualization of what we think it should be, but the Buddha's is using mindfulness of breathing as a focal point, so that you can start to, your awareness can start to encompass all the different elements of our experience. Then we start to learn, then we start to see things clearly. Okay. Well, Paul, for this 10-day retreat, what is your Dhamma wish for us? Well, well, I mean, I wish that people have the experience of peace and clarity, because it's that peace and clarity, and even if it's just glimmers, and that's really the encouragement and motivation, and okay, this practice really works. It's the real deal. In practice, we are often doing battle with our defilements. Can you speak about ways of gladdening the heart? Stop doing battle with your defilements. Quit picking a fight with them. You just go around picking fights and you end up bruised and battered. I don't know about anybody else, but where I grew up, it was a pretty rough town, and it was always people, Friday night, Saturday night, they'd always be in fights. And so, okay. And they said, oh, why is it like this? Well, if you'd stop picking the fights, stop being stupid, it wouldn't be a problem. So I think one of the things is how we conceive of that sort of us against them and me against the defilements. And sometimes, sometimes we're, there's a certain kind of assumption that somehow that's, just working ourselves up into to get energy in that way is useful. But it's tiring. So to be able to start recognizing that they, again, my Dhamma wish for people is that they gain some peace and clarity, so that it starts to become clear that the biggest obstacle is our own, oftentimes our own conception of ourselves, our own conception of the world around us, and just to recognize that within us we have the ability to perceive truth, perceive the way things truly are, and we all have really wholesome qualities. We have good qualities that we can lift up and give importance to and rely on. So that to just learning how to encourage ourselves, that's a really important way of and dealing with that, because it's true. I mean, there are, we all have the other side as well. We have our shadow side of the unskillful, but we don't need to really react to it in ways that give those qualities energy. So lifting up the skillful is really important. In the Mindful Breathing Sutta, what is the difference between quote-unquote mind and mental fabrication? And what is meant by satisfying the mind in step 10? Mind is literally translated jitta, so that encompasses all of the qualities of what we in the English language would be, mind, heart, emotional, cognitive functions of the mind, discursive functions of the mind. All of that is what the mind is. And mental fabrication is, those things that construct the energy, the movement within the mind. And then the satisfying the mind is sometimes translated as gladdening the mind, satisfying the mind. The Pali word is abhipamojayam, which is to, as almost you more literally, to delight the mind. And so that learning how to, to brighten the mind. So that one works with the mind. So again, where one becomes proactive rather than passively waiting for, one sits and watch the breath go in and out. And they say the mind is supposed to become bright. And you keep waiting and waiting. I've been doing this for 50 years now. So, by directing attention to what are ways that one can satisfy, gladden, and delight, and bring up ways of directing attention that help the mind to have those objects or moods or states of mind. Okay, the very bottom is forgive me for my English, but the so there I'll do a bit of interpretation. Okay, can Ajahn Pazano teach us how Ajahn Chah teaches or gives techniques on meditations on physical state, mind and mind states, and so that Ajahn Chah would on a certain level there's the kind of dichotomy or perception of body-mind is, especially in the English language, is really conditioned by Christianity and Christian ideas of there being a huge split and the body being carnal and pulling one down, and the mind needing to be released so that it can rise up to the divine. And from a Buddhist perspective, and certainly Ajahn Chah, it's a lot more maybe mundane or nitty gritty, in the sense of one is paying attention to both the say physical and mental conditions, so that one is saying, well, what is it that leads to well-being or wholesome qualities? And intrinsically, none of them are, whether it's the body or the mind, they're not, intrinsically going to pull one down or lift one up. Anyway, it's how one directs attention and how the views and ways that one perceives that are going to create the difference. Oftentimes, just using the examples of how we relate to the body or the mind, either in ways of desire or fear or worries, being Ajahn Chah would really hone in on that sometimes and really, sometimes just make us look at it without having saying anything. It's just like, simple example of in a monastery like Ajahn Chah's or most monasteries, but Ajahn Chah was kind of a master at it, where mealtime, everybody's hungry, we eat one meal a day, you're hungry. And you can't start eating until the senior monk starts eating. And then he starts, engaging in conversation with the villagers and the lay people who come, and it's just this, hearing about people's buffaloes and their and their grandchildren, and it's sort of the physical and mental state start to become apparent. see how that works, or just as where he would, don't admonish anybody, don't point out anybody's faults before the meal. So that's usually disaster. So it's these work together, so that if you've got an issue with somebody, yeah, wait until they've had their meal, they're happy, and then engage in it. And these are simple things, but these are physical and mental states they flow back and forth. The last part of the question is can you tell us more about Ajahn Chah's biography and his example? For example, when and how Ajahn Chah wanted to become a monk. We'll see what happens when I go to Thailand. I think the English biography of Ajahn Chah is very close to being completed. Ajahn Jayasaro was really keen to have it finished by the end of the rains retreat, and of course he didn't. He's a perfectionist. But I think he's getting very, very close. And Tankovilo from Abhayagiri has Ajahn Jayasaro invited him to come and spend the rains retreat nearby, and he's been working on the editing and being another eye on the. And he said there's still just a couple chapters that Ajahn Jayasaro is not quite happy with, but basically everything is together, it's in place, so it's getting close. The story an example of Ajahn Chah and how he wanted to become a monk. Of course, northeast Thailand, there's a very, very strong Buddhist culture, and when you grow up in the culture, and it's just everywhere around you. And it's even, in comparison to the other areas of Thailand, the regions of Thailand, northeast of Thailand is really the most, say, devout, tremendous faith. And so that's surrounded by Buddhism and people practicing, going to the temple. He probably started going to the temple when, shortly after he was born, and they started carrying him there. And then he'd go and go to the temple and help out in the monastery, and just be, because there's Buddhist monasteries. I think in Thai culture, the walls, either they're non-existent or they're incredibly permeable. It's just this flow back and forth between the lay world and the monastic world. And anyway, Ajahn Chah talks about his own inspiration for wanting to ordain. And he said, as he was growing up, it's a farming village, and you have various chores and duties which everybody does if you grow up in a village structure, in a family structure. Some things he wasn't really happy with. His parents having to go out and water the tobacco plants every day. And he said, I had to go and water those tobacco plants every day, and I didn't smoke. It was the adults who smoked, and I had to, and I didn't. So he had grumbled and complained about that. And then seeing the onerous nature of being in the world and doing things that didn't make sense or didn't feel right, and And then his sister talked about his kind of when he made his decision to go to stay in the monastery. He said he'd been, his sister said, you know, he'd been doing pounding rice, which you do on the, you have a long wooden pole and you stand on one end and it goes up and pounds it. And he was supposed to be holding like a pestle. And he was, his sister said he was, his heart wasn't in it and he didn't want to be doing it. Something that he was, had some objection to. And anyway, he wasn't paying attention, and the mortar came down, snapped this piece of wood, came up, hit him, and it hurt. And he said, "That's it. I'm going to the monastery." And he packed his stuff, and he was 9 years old. And that was his. He left home. He was he's done with the world. Can you talk about working with the practice in what seems like perilous times? For example, the rise in overt expressions of hatred toward sectors of society and the associated change in national leadership. How does one cultivate equanimity while also not turning away? Again, there's a difference between equanimity and indifference, and it's a really important distinction. Equanimity is also always seen as part and parcel of, on the spectrum of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. So they're not individual things, and they're not separate from, say, compassion or kindness. So to be lifting up those qualities of kindness and concern and integrity that we want to see manifest in the world, and to do that ourselves rather than turning to, say, indifference or shutting down or reacting out of fear or reacting out of aversion. So that that is that's a really important piece of the puzzle of how do we deal with this skillfully? And when by curbing our own, say, frustration, aversion, and realize, because it, you know, it doesn't. In the Dhammapada, the verse, hatred is never overcome by hatred; it's always overcome by loving kindness. And loving kindness doesn't mean that one doesn't recognize or see that which is unskillful, inappropriate, but it's responding in a way that is not feeding the cycle of hatred. And it's just so important to get that piece of the puzzle. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why this has been such a divisive period in history, is everybody's got righteous anger and righteous indignation, and it just keeps feeding on itself. And so that to be able to be willing to, and I think it comes back, you know, say like one of the, because last night I talked about the, say the King of Thailand, and, you know, what is the one thing that say we could ask for from America or from President Nixon in that case, but that, and the King saying understanding, and I think it's important to be able to lift that up within ourselves. How do we create more understanding? How do we foster that? How do we do that for ourselves and do that for the people around us? And that opens up a lot of different possibilities. It seems I can quiet my mind easier in the midst of noise. It's been one continuous monkey mind. Please help. Would you give a guidance towards jhana, please? I think one of the things is saying, I think the operative word is it seems. So it seems I can quiet my mind easier in the midst of noise. But you know, usually, it's basically when there's a lot of noise happening, then we don't have to listen to our own crap. Sort of, it's pulling our attention out. So then, once we're in a very quiet, settled environment, then it starts to become more apparent. Wow, mind is really it's really out of control. I remember years ago, one of the things I did was establish a branch monastery of Wat Nana Chat, and it was along the border of Laos, very rural area, right just above the Mekong River, incredibly beautiful, and it was hills and forest. And it's a different kind of forest. There's a lot more open space with a lot of rock, beautiful rock formations, incredibly, physically very beautiful, and one of the quietest places that I've experienced in Thailand. And the first year that we set the place up, then I went and spent the rains retreat. And about halfway through the retreat, I remember asking one of the young monks, as I was delighting in being there, and it was great. And I kind of said, "Oh, how's your range retreat going? How's your practice going?" And so all kind of bubbly. He said, "Oh, terrible." "Terrible? I was, why is that?" "I've got nobody to blame anymore." it was really honest. It was great. But it was sort of that feeling of, there's things impinging. I said, it isn't my mind. Something is doing it to me. So being able to recognize and picking up that, okay, the monkey mind, what's it? It's like in those hindrances that I was saying, they're it's dukkha in the expression of it, but it's also a way that we respond to dukkha, so that we're trying to alleviate it by getting out of it, keeping the mind busy. So being willing to look more closely. What's going on underneath that monkey mind? What's it trying to accomplish? What's it trying to get? What's its feeling? And relating, and you start to, oh, you poor thing. you really want to care for it. So that rather than trying to force the mind to be quiet or being disappointed because it isn't, look into how can you care for it. Say, with virtuous leaders passing away and unvirtuous ones coming into power, is the world entering a dark period? Was there any predictions from the forest masters about this? I think they probably said, this is the way it works. is they come and they go, you know, and it's, you know, it's kind of, it sounds really trite, and if one, if that's the only position one takes, then it is trite, but, you know, I think that, you know, recognizing that, yeah, virtuous leaders have an effect that's qualitatively different than those who aren't, and to be able to just appreciate when there is those examples of virtue there, and to be alert to those that aren't, and you know, and certainly the I don't think the, say, the world is entering a dark period. It's just as it's doing what it's always done. So there's, you know, certainly the, in terms of forest masters, the encouragement is always the recognizing that we can take responsibility for our life, we can take responsibility for our well-being, we can take responsibility for the well-being of the people around us, and when we do that, then the world starts to qualitatively change as well. Okay, that's interesting. What about aversions that have a message? Is a signal to understanding something. How is one to trust that from the regular aversion? I think one of the things that, and it is important to recognize that when the Buddha talks about causal processes, it is important to recognize that it's how we relate to them that's important. Because Buddha said, like, the wholesome can be the causal condition for the arising of the unwholesome. The unwholesome can be the causal condition for the arising of the wholesome. Of course, the same wholesome can be a condition for the arising of the wholesome. Unwholesome can be a condition for the arising of the unwholesome. So that everything is up for grabs, and it's how we relate to it, how we perceive it, how skillfully we respond to it. So that sometimes, just like that, where, say, an aversion comes into the mind, and it either gives an insight, or gives a warning, or gives an encouragement in some way, shape, or form that sort of wakes one up, and one responds in a wholesome way. And that's our response, because we could just as soon meet aversion with more aversion, or just shrink back out of fear or something. But we can respond to even the unwholesome with that which is wholesome and skillful. And one of the qualities that the Buddha points to that sort of integral to the whole path is, say, of heedfulness, appamatta. So being heedful, being circumspect, so that when we do experience that which is, say, unwholesome, there's a quality of circumspection, alertness, attentiveness, that can transform that. And similarly, say, when there's a lack of circumspection, a lack of presence of clarity, then even when we experience what is wholesome, we can get caught up in some unwholesome reaction to it, unskillful reaction to it. We can just lose the plot on that. When talking with friends, sometimes the topic of faith and religion comes up. Normally, I find this topic pleasant and enjoyable, but on occasion, I find myself in conversation with somebody who believes, often quite insistently, that their faith is, quote-unquote, the only way. Do you have any advice on how I might skillfully navigate these situations? I mean, one is to have the internal confidence in your own faith and your own belief and your own way of living a religious life, that one doesn't have to say argue or try to convince somebody, because a lot of it's in your own example and presence of living that has a bigger effect than trying to convince somebody or argue with them. I mean, I find those kind of conversations just really don't go very far, or don't really have much substance. So it tends to be pretty much a waste of time often. But it doesn't mean you write the person off, but it's more like by living an example of a skillful life, and also just, I mean, sometimes just pointing out the aspects of commonality is helpful in terms of what is it that is different, but sometimes it's hard. So if they're insistent, so that then you're just knowing, okay, it's a tactical retreat is an option. That's important. Jan, what is your instruction regarding the Noble Eightfold Path and the most useful attitude toward the word right? Of course, I mean, I think one of the things like yesterday I gave a couple talks on, the gradual path, the gradual training, gradual instruction. And the Eightfold Path is another expression of that, so that there is this gradual or graduated or a certain systematic way of practicing of training oneself in virtue, in meditation, in discernment, and that being the Eightfold Path. And then I think the most useful attitude toward the word right is extending one's definition of that and recognizing that the 'cause usually when we think of, in English, we think of right. And then if it's not right, then it's wrong. Or it has to be right. Yeah. But that isn't the way that... Say, I think Ajahn Jeff points to something extremely useful in the roots of the word. For some, the word that was translated as right is actually a word that's used in musical theory a lot. So rather than being right in terms of exclusively right, it's more like right in tune. Right in the sense that it harmonizes with the other factors of the path, so that when you expand your perspective on the word right in terms of right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, that these are right, not in the sense that they're in that sense of black and white, right and wrong, but they're right in the sense that there's a harmonizing quality, there's a right in tune, or they're just right. Because the whole purpose of the path is that it's a path leading to the cessation of suffering. So that when it's, say, just right, then suffering ceases. Whereas desperately trying to get it absolutely right usually creates more suffering. During the Christmas holiday, I'm going to be spending some time with relatives who do not share my same political views. In the spirit of wanting to understand their views and wanting to heal the divide that exists in our country, I want to talk about the election with them. How do I have this conversation skillfully? I would just not have the in the sense sometimes there's nothing more irritating than having somebody want to have this conversation with you about the something that's already really quite divisive and traumatic. I mean, it'll come up in different ways anyway. And to really be attentive to not sort of adding fuel or being divisive oneself, or being sarcastic, or being belittling, or being 'cause that again, in terms of it comes back to the previous question of right. Is trying to be right. And of course, when you're right and you really want to understand how these people can be so wrong, it's really not a good start. And that goes all across the board. It's not just one. It doesn't go one way. It goes all across the board. And so that going and certainly wanting to understand is really important. What is it? What's happening in their life? And what is it that can be a part of? How can we one be part of a process of healing, and how can one listen, and how can one contribute in ways that are going to be a force for kind of elevating a conversation to something about human qualities and human interest rather than political interest. And that's that takes some skill and some restraint as well. So and sometimes you're learning how to just this isn't the time to say that, and being circumspect. That's all the questions.